In New Mexico, Latinos fought for land and water rights against real estate developers who tried to throw them off land they had lived on for decades. In 1988, there was a confrontation, and the people organized an armed occupation, built bunkers for protection against attack, and won support from other communities in the Southwest. Finally, a court ruled in their favor. Abnormal rates of cancer for farm workers in California aroused the Chicano community. Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers fasted for 35 days in 1988 to call attention to these conditions. There were now United Farm Workers unions in Texas, Arizona, and other states. The importation of Mexican workers for low wages, under terrible conditions, spread from the Southwest to other parts of the country. By 1991, 80,000 Latinos lived in North Carolina, 30,000 in North Georgia. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which had won a difficult strike in the Ohio tomato fields in 1979, the largest agricultural strike ever in the Midwest, brought thousands of farm workers together in several Midwest states. As the Latino population of the country kept growing, it soon matched the 12% of the population that was African American and began to have a distinct effect on American culture. Much of its music, art, and drama was much more consciously political and satirical than mainstream culture. The Border Arts Workshop was formed in 1984 by artists and writers in San Diego and Tijuana, and its work dealt powerfully with issues of racism and injustice. In Northern California, Teatro Campesino and Teatro de la Esperanza performed for working people all over the country, turning schoolhouses, churches, and fields into theaters. Latinos were especially conscious of the imperial role the United States had played in Mexico and the Caribbean, and many of them became militant critics of U.S. policy toward Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Cuba. In 1970, a great march in Los Angeles against the Vietnam War, which had been attacked by police, left three Chicanos dead. When the Bush administration was preparing for war against Iraq in the summer of 1990, thousands of people in Los Angeles marched along the same route they had taken 20 years before when they were protesting the Vietnam War. As Elizabeth Martinet wrote, 500 Years of Chicano History in Pictures, before enduring President Bush's war in the Persian Gulf, many people, including Raza, literally race, a term adopted by Latino activists, had doubts about it or were opposed. We had learned some lessons about wars started in the name of democracy that turned out to benefit only the rich and powerful. Raza mobilized to protest this war of mass murder even faster than the U.S. war in Vietnam, though we could not stop it. In 1992, a fundraising group which came out of the Vietnam War called Resist made donations to 168 organizations around the country, community groups, peace groups, Native American groups, prisoners' rights organizations, health and environmental groups. A new generation of lawyers, schooled in the 60s, constituted a small but socially conscious minority within the legal profession. They were in court defending the poor and the helpless, or bringing suit against powerful corporations. One law firm used its talent and energy to defend whistleblowers, men and women who were fired because they blew the whistle on corporate corruption that victimized the public. The women's movement, which had managed to raise the consciousness of the whole nation on the issue of sexual equality, faced a powerful backlash in the 80s. The Supreme Court's defense of abortion rights in its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision aroused a pro-life movement that had strong supporters in Washington. Congress passed, and the Supreme Court later let stand, a law that eliminated federal medical benefits to help poor women pay for abortions. But the National Organization of Women and other groups remained strong. In 1989, a Washington rally for what had come to be known as the right to choose drew over 300,000 people. When in 1994 and 1995, abortion clinics were attacked and several supporters murdered, the conflict became grimly intense. The rights of gay and lesbian Americans had come vividly to the forefront in the 70s with radical changes in ideas about sexuality and freedom. The gay movement then became a visible presence in the nation with parades, demonstrations, campaigns for the elimination of state statutes discriminating against homosexuals. One result was a growing literature about the hidden history of gay life in the United States and in Europe. In 1994, there was a Stonewall 25 march in Manhattan, which commemorated an event homosexuals regarded as a turning point. 25 years earlier, gay men fought back vigorously against the police raid on the Stonewall Bar in Greenwich Village. In the early 90s, gay and lesbian groups campaigned more openly, more determinedly, against discrimination, and for more attention to the scourge of AIDS, which they claimed was being given only marginal attention by the national government. In Rochester, New York, a local campaign achieved an unprecedented decision barring military recruiters from a school district because of the Defense Department discrimination against gay soldiers. The labor movement in the 80s and 90s was considerably weakened by the decline of manufacturing, by the flight of factories to other countries, by the hostility of the Reagan administration and its appointees on the National Labor Relations Board. Yet organizing continued, especially among white-collar workers and low-income people of color. The AFL-CIO put on hundreds of new organizers to work among Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans. Rank-and-file workers in old, stagnant unions began to rebel. In 1991, the notoriously corrupt leadership of the powerful Teamsters Union was voted out of office by a reform slate. The new leadership immediately became a force in Washington and took the lead in working for independent political coalitions outside the two major parties. But the labor movement as a whole, much diminished, was struggling for survival. Against the overwhelming power of corporate wealth and governmental authority, the spirit of resistance was kept alive in the early 90s, often by small-scale acts of courage and defiance. On the West Coast, a young activist named Keith McHenry and hundreds of others were arrested again and again for distributing free food to poor people without a license. They were part of a program called Food Not Bombs. More Food Not Bombs groups sprang up in communities around the country. In 1992, a New York group interested in revising traditional ideas about American history received approval from the New York City Council to put up 30 metal plaques high on lampposts around the city. One of them, placed opposite the Morgan corporate headquarters, identified the famous banker J.P. Morgan as a Civil War draft dodger. In fact, Morgan had avoided the draft and profited in business deals with the government during the war. Another plaque, placed near the stock exchange, portrayed a suicide and carried the label "Advantage of an Unregulated Free Market." The general disillusionment with government during the Vietnam years and the Watergate scandals, the exposure of anti-democratic actions by the FBI and the CIA, led to resignations from government and open criticism by former employees. A number of former CIA officials left the agency and wrote books critical of its activities. John Stockwell, who had headed the CIA operation in Angola, resigned, wrote a book exposing the CIA activities, and lectured all over the country about his experiences. David McMichael, a historian and former CIA specialist, testified at trials on behalf of people who had protested government policy in Central America. FBI agent Jack Ryan, a 21-year veteran of the Bureau, was fired when he refused to investigate peace groups. He was deprived of his pension and for some time had to live in a shelter for homeless people. Sometimes the war in Vietnam, which had ended in 1975, came back to public attention in the 80s and 90s through people who had been involved in the conflicts of that day. Some of them had since made dramatic turnabouts in their thinking. John Wall, who prosecuted Dr. Benjamin Spock and four others in Boston for conspiring to obstruct the draft, showed up at a dinner honoring the defendants in 1994, saying the trial had changed his ideas. Even more striking was the statement by Charles Hutto, a U.S. soldier who had participated in the atrocity known as the My Lai Massacre, in which a company of American soldiers shot to death women and children by the hundreds in a tiny Vietnamese village. Interviewed in the 80s, Hutto told a reporter, "I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to go, to serve their country, but to use their own judgment at times, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind. It was this legacy of the Vietnam War, the feeling among a great majority of Americans that it was a terrible tragedy, a war that should not have been fought, that plagued the Reagan and Bush administrations, which still hoped to extend American power around the world. In 1985, when George Bush was vice president, former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger had warned the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Vietnam brought a sea change in domestic attitudes, a breakdown in the political consensus behind foreign policy. When Bush became president, he was determined to overcome what came to be called the Vietnam Syndrome, the resistance of the American people to a war desired by the establishment. And so he launched the air war against Iraq in mid-January 1991 with overwhelming force so the war could be over quickly, before there was time for a national anti-war movement to develop. The signs of a possible movement were there in the months of the pre-war buildup. On Halloween, 600 students marched through downtown Missoula, Montana, shouting, "Hell no, we won't go." In Shreveport, Louisiana, despite the Shreveport Journal's front-page headline, "Poll Favors Military Action," the story was that 42% of the respondents thought the USAID should initiate force, and 41% said, "Wait and see." The November 11, 1990 Veterans Parade in Boston was joined by a group called Veterans for Peace, carrying signs, "No more Vietnams, bring 'em home now," and "Oil and blood do not mix, wage peace." The Boston Globe reported that the protesters were greeted with respectful applause and at some places strong demonstrations of support by onlookers. One of those onlookers, a woman named Mary Belay Dressier, said, "Personally, parades that honor the military are somewhat troublesome to me because the military is about war, and war is troublesome to me." Most Vietnam veterans were supporting military action, but there was a strong dissident minority. In one survey that showed 53% of the veterans polled saying they would gladly serve in the Gulf War, 37% said they would not. Perhaps the most famous Vietnam veteran, Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July, made a 30-second television speech as Bush moved toward war. In the appeal, broadcast on 200 television stations in 120 cities across the country, he asked all citizens to stand up and speak out against war. "How many more Americans coming home in wheelchairs like me will it take before we learn?" That November of 1990, several months into the Kuwait crisis, college students in St. Paul, Minnesota, demonstrated against war, the local press reported. It was a full-blown anti-war demonstration with mothers pushing kids in strollers, college professors and grade school teachers carrying signs, peace activists bedecked in peace symbols, and hundreds of students from a dozen schools singing, beating drums, and chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, we won't fight for Amoco." 10 days before the bombing began at a town meeting in Boulder, Colorado, with 800 people present, the question was put, "Do you support Bush's policy for war?" Only 4 people raised their hands. A few days before the war began, 4,000 people in Santa Fe, New Mexico, blocked a 4-lane highway for an hour, asking that there be no war. Residents said this was larger than any demonstration in the Vietnam era. On the eve of the war, 6,000 people marched through Ann Arbor, Michigan, to ask for peace. On the night the war began, 5,000 people gathered in San Francisco to denounce the war and formed a human chain around the federal building. Police broke the chain by swinging their clubs at the hands of the protesters. But the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution declaring the city and county a sanctuary for those who, for moral, ethical, or religious reasons, cannot participate in a war. The night before Bush gave the order to launch the bombing, a 7-year-old girl in Lexington, Massachusetts, told her mother she wanted to write a letter to the president. Her mother suggested it was late and she should write the next day. "No, tonight," the girl said. She was still learning to write, so she dictated a letter. "Dear President Bush, I don't like the way you are behaving. If you would make up your mind there won't be a war, we won't have to have peace vigils. If you were in a war, you wouldn't want to get hurt. What I'm saying is, I don't want any fighting to happen. Sincerely yours, Serena Cabot." After the bombing of Iraq began, along with the bombardment of public opinion, the polls showed overwhelming support for Bush's action, and this continued through the 6 weeks of the war. But was it an accurate reflection of the citizenry's long-term feelings about war? The split vote in the polls just before the war reflected a public still thinking its opinion might have an effect. Once the war was on, and clearly irreversible, in an atmosphere charged with patriotic fervor, the president of the United Church of Christ spoke of the steady drumbeat of war messages, it was not surprising that a great majority of the country would declare its support. Nevertheless, even with little time to organize, and with the war over very fast, there was an opposition, a minority for sure, but a determined one, and with the potential to grow. Compared to the first months of the military escalation in Vietnam, the movement against the Gulf War expanded with extraordinary speed and vigor. That first week of the war, while it was clear most Americans were supporting Bush's action, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in protest in towns and cities all over the country. In Athens, Ohio, over 100 people were arrested as they clashed with a pro-war group. In Portland, Maine, 500 marched wearing white armbands or carrying white paper crosses with one word, Y, written in red. At the University of Georgia, 70 students opposed to the war held an all-night vigil, and in the Georgia legislature, Representative Cynthia McKinnon made a speech attacking the bombing of Iraq, leading many of the other legislators to walk off the floor. She held her ground, and it seemed that there had been at least some change in thinking, since Representative Julian Bond was expelled from the very same legislature for criticizing the war in Vietnam during the 1960s. At a junior high school in Newton, Massachusetts, 350 students marched to City Hall to present a petition to the mayor declaring their opposition to the war in the Gulf. Clearly, many were trying to reconcile their feelings about war with their sympathy for soldiers sent to the Middle East. A student leader, Carrie Baker, said, "We don't think bloodshed is the right way. We are supporting the troops and are proud of them, but we don't want war." In Ada, Oklahoma, while East Central Oklahoma State University was adopting two National Guard units, two young women sat quietly on top of the concrete entrance gate with signs that read, "Teach peace, not war." One of them, Patricia Biggs, said, "I don't think we should be over there. I don't think it's about justice and liberty. I think it's about economics. The big oil corporations have a lot to do with what is going on over there. We are risking people's lives for money." 4 days after the United States launched its air attack, 75,000 people, the estimate of the Capitol Police, marched in Washington, rallying near the White House to denounce the war. In Southern California, Ron Kovic addressed 6,000 people, who chanted, "Peace now." In Fayetteville, Arkansas, a group supporting military policy was confronted by the Northwest Arkansas Citizens Against War, who marched carrying a flag-draped coffin and a banner that read, "Bring them home alive." Another disabled Vietnam veteran, a professor of history and political science at York College in Pennsylvania, named Philip Avillo, wrote in a local newspaper, "Yes, we need to support our men and women under arms, but let's support them by bringing them home, not by condoning this barbarous, violent policy." In Salt Lake City, hundreds of demonstrators, many with children, marched through the city's main streets chanting anti-war slogans. In Vermont, which had just elected socialist Bernie Sanders to Congress, over 2,000 demonstrators disrupted a speech by the governor at the State House, and in Burlington, Vermont's largest city, 300 protesters walked through the downtown area asking shop owners to close their doors in solidarity. On January 26, 9 days after the beginning of the war, over 150,000 people marched through the streets of Washington, D.C., and listened to speakers denounce the war, including the movie stars Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins. A woman from Oakland, California, held up the folded American flag that was given to her when her husband was killed in Vietnam, saying, "I learned the hard way. There is no glory in a folded flag." Labor unions had supported the war in Vietnam for the most part, but after the bombing started in the Gulf, 11 affiliates of the AFL-CIO, including some of its more powerful unions like steel, auto, communications, chemical workers, spoke out against the war. The black community was far less enthusiastic than the rest of the country about what the U.S. Air Force was doing to Iraq. An ABC News Washington Post poll in early February 1991 found that support for the war was 84% among whites, but only 48% among African Americans. When the war had been going on for a month, with Iraq devastated by the incessant bombing, there were feelers from Saddam Hussein that Iraq would withdraw from Kuwait if the United States would stop its attacks. Bush rejected the idea, and a meeting of black leaders in New York sharply criticized him, calling the war an immoral and unspiritual diversion, a blatant evasion of our domestic responsibilities. In Selma, Alabama, which had been the scene of bloody police violence against civil rights marchers 26 years before, a meeting to observe the anniversary of that bloody Sunday demanded that our troops be brought home alive to fight for justice at home. The father of a 21-year-old Marine in the Persian Gulf, Alex Molnar, wrote an angry open letter published in the New York Times to President Bush. "Where were you, Mr. President, when Iraq was killing its own people with poison gas? Why, until the recent crisis, was it business as usual with Saddam Hussein, the man you now call a Hitler? Is the American way of life that you say my son is risking his life for the continued right of Americans to consume 25% to 30% of the world's oil? I intend to support my son and his fellow soldiers by doing everything I can to oppose any offensive American military action in the Persian Gulf." There were courageous individual acts by citizens speaking out in spite of threats. Peg Mullen of Brownsville, Texas, whose son had been killed by friendly fire in Vietnam, organized a busload of mothers to protest in Washington, in spite of a warning that her house would be burned down if she persisted. The actress Margot Kidder, Lois Lane in the Superman films, despite the risk to her career, spoke out eloquently against the war. A basketball player for Seton Hall University in New Jersey refused to wear the American flag on his uniform, and when he became the object of derision for this, he left the team and the university and returned to his native Italy. More tragically, a Vietnam veteran in Los Angeles set fire to himself and died to protest the war. In Amherst, Massachusetts, a young man carrying a cardboard peace sign knelt on the town common, poured two cans of flammable fluid on himself, struck two matches, and died in the flames. 2 hours later, students from nearby universities gathered on the common for a candlelight vigil and placed peace signs at the site of death. One of the signs read, "Stop this crazy war." There was no time, as there had been during the Vietnam conflict, for a large anti-war movement to develop in the military. But there were men and women who defied their commanders and refused to participate in the war. When the first contingents of U.S. troops were being sent to Saudi Arabia in August of 1990, Corporal Jeff Patterson, a 22-year-old Marine stationed in Hawaii, sat down on the runway of the airfield and refused to board a plane bound for Saudi Arabia. He asked to be discharged from the Marine Corps. "I have come to believe that there are no justified wars. I began to question exactly what I was doing in the Marine Corps about the time I began to read about history. I began to read up on America's support for the murderous regimes of Guatemala, Iran under the Shah, and El Salvador. I object to the military use of force against any people, anywhere, anytime." 14 Marine Corps reservists at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, filed for conscientious objector status, despite the prospect of a court-martial for desertion. A lance corporal in the Marines, Eric Larson, issued a statement. "I declare myself a conscientious objector. Here is my sea bag full of personal gear. Here is my gas mask. I no longer need them. I am no longer a Marine. It, to me, is embarrassing to fight for a way of life in which basic human needs, like a place to sleep, one hot meal a day, and some medical attention, cannot even be met in our nation's capital." Corporal Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, a physician who was a captain in the Army Reserve Medical Corps, a mother of three young children, and a member of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, was called to active duty in December 1990, a month before the start of the war. She replied, "I am refusing orders to be an accomplice in what I consider an immoral, inhumane, and unconstitutional act, namely an offensive military mobilization in the Middle East." She was court-martialed, convicted of desertion, and sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Another soldier, Stephanie Atkinson of Murfreesboro, Illinois, refused to report for active duty, saying she thought the U.S. military was in the Persian Gulf solely for economic reasons. She was first placed under house arrest, then given a discharge under other than honorable conditions. An Army physician named Harlow Ballard, stationed at Fort Devens in Massachusetts, refused to follow an order to go to Saudi Arabia. "I would rather go to jail than support this war," he said. "I don't believe there is any such thing as a just war." Over 1,000 reservists declared themselves conscientious objectors. A 23-year-old Marine Corps reservist named Rob Calibro was one of them. "My father tells me that he's ashamed of me. He screams at me that he's embarrassed by me. But I believe that killing people is morally wrong. I believe I'm serving my country more by being true to my conscience than by living a lie." An information network sprang up during the Gulf War to tell what was not being told in the major media. There were alternative newspapers in many cities. There were over 100 community radio stations able to reach only a fraction of those tuned into the major networks, but the only sources, during the Gulf War, of critical analyses of the war. An ingenious radio person in Boulder, Colorado, named David Barsamian, recorded a speech by Noam Chomsky made at Harvard, a devastating critique of the war. He then sent the cassette out to his network of community stations, which were eager for a point of view different from the official one. Two young men in New Jersey then transcribed the talk, put it in pamphlet form, in a shape easily photocopied, and placed the pamphlets in bookstores all over the country. After victorious wars, there is almost always a sobering effect, as the war fervor wears off, and citizens assess the costs and wonder what was gained. War fever was at its height in February 1991. In that month, when people being polled were reminded of the huge costs of the war, only 17% said the war was not worth it. 4 months later, in June, the figure was 30%. In the month that followed, Bush's support in the nation dropped steeply as economic conditions deteriorated. And in 1992, with the war spirit evaporated, Bush went down to defeat. After the disintegration of the Soviet bloc began in 1989, there had been talk in the United States of a peace dividend, the opportunity to take billions of dollars from the military budget and use it for human needs. The war in the Gulf became a convenient excuse for the government determined to stop such talk. A member of the Bush administration said, "We owe Saddam a favor. He saved us from the peace dividend." New York Times, March 2, 1991. But the idea of a peace dividend could not be stifled so long as Americans were in need. Shortly after the war, historian Marilyn Young warned, "The U.S. can destroy Iraq's highways, but not build its own, create the conditions for epidemic in Iraq, but not offer health care to millions of Americans. It can excoriate Iraqi treatment of the Kurdish minority, but not deal with domestic race relations, create homelessness abroad, but not solve it here, keep 500,000 troops drug-free as part of a war, but refuse to fund the treatment of millions of drug addicts at home. We shall lose the war after we have won it." In 1992, the limits of military victory became apparent during the quincentennial celebrations of Columbus's arrival in the Western Hemisphere. 500 years ago, Columbus and his fellow conquerors had wiped out the native population of Hispaniola. This was followed during the next 4 centuries by the methodical destruction of Indian tribes by the United States government as it marched across the continent. By now, there was a dramatic reaction. The Indians, the Native Americans, had become a visible force since the 60s and 70s, and in 1992 were joined by other Americans to denounce the quincentennial celebrations. For the first time in all the years that the country had celebrated Columbus Day, there were nationwide protests against honoring a man who had kidnapped, enslaved, mutilated, murdered the natives who greeted his arrival with gifts and friendship. Preparations for the quincentennial began on both sides of the controversy. Official commissions, nationally and in the states, were set up long before the year of the quincentennial. This spurred action by Native Americans. In the summer of 1990, 350 Indians, representatives from all over the hemisphere, met in Quito, Ecuador, at the first intercontinental gathering of indigenous people in the Americas to mobilize against the glorification of the Columbus conquest. The following summer, in Davis, California, over 100 Native Americans gathered for a follow-up meeting to the Quito Conference. They declared October 12, 1992, International Day of Solidarity with Indigenous People, and resolved to inform the King of Spain that the replicas of Columbus's three ships, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, will not receive permission from the Native nations to land in the Western Hemisphere unless he apologizes for the original incursion 500 years ago. The movement grew. The largest ecumenical body in the United States, the National Council of Churches, called on Christians to refrain from celebrating the Columbus Quincentennial, saying, "What represented newness of freedom, hope, and opportunity for some was the occasion for oppression, degradation, and genocide for others." The National Endowment for the Humanities funded a traveling expedition called First Encounter, which romanticized the Columbus conquest. When the exhibition opened at the Florida Museum of Natural History, Michelle Diamond, a freshman at the University of Florida, climbed aboard a replica of one of Columbus's ships with a sign reading, "Exhibit teaches racism." She said, "It's a human issue, not just a red Indian issue." She was arrested and charged with trespassing, but demonstrations continued for 16 days against the exhibit. A newspaper called Indigenous Thought began publication in early 1991 to create a link among all the counter-Columbus quincentenary activities. It carried articles by Native Americans about current struggles over land stolen by treaty. In Corpus Christi, Texas, Indians and Chicanos joined to protest the city's celebrations of the quincentennial. A woman named Angelina Mendez spoke for the Chicanos. "The Chicano Nation, in solidarity with our Indian brothers and sisters to the north, come together with them on this day to denounce the atrocity the U.S. government proposes in reenacting the arrival of the Spanish, more specifically, the arrival of Cristobal Colón to the shores of this land." The Columbus controversy brought an extraordinary burst of educational and cultural activity. A professor at the University of California at San Diego, Deborah Small, put together an exhibit of over 200 paintings on wood panels called 1492. She juxtaposed words from Columbus's diary with blown-up fragments from 16th-century engravings to dramatize the horrors that accompanied Columbus's arrival in the hemisphere. A reviewer wrote that it does remind us in the most vivid way of how the coming of Western-style civilization to the New World doesn't provide us with a sunny tale. When President Bush attacked Iraq in 1991, claiming that he was acting to end the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, a group of Native Americans in Oregon distributed a biting and ironic open letter. "Dear President Bush, please send your assistance in freeing our small nation from occupation. This foreign force occupied our lands to steal our rich resources. They used biological warfare and deceit, killing thousands of elders, children, and women in the process. As they overwhelmed our land, they deposed our leaders and people of our own government, and in its place, they installed their own government systems that yet today control our daily lives in many ways. As in your own words, the occupation and overthrow of one small nation is one too many. Sincerely, an American Indian." The publication Rethinking Schools, which represented socially conscious school teachers all over the country, printed a 100-page book called Rethinking Columbus, featuring articles by Native Americans and others, a critical review of children's books on Columbus, a listing of resources for people wanting more information on Columbus, and more reading material on counter-quincentenary activities. In a few months, 200,000 copies of the book were sold. A Portland, Oregon teacher named Bill Bigelow, who helped put together Rethinking Schools, took a year off from his regular job to tour the country in 1992, giving workshops to other teachers so that they could begin to tell those truths about the Columbus experience that were omitted from the traditional books and class curricula. One of Bigelow's own students wrote to the publisher, Allen and Bacon, with a critique of their history text, The American Spirit. "I'll just pick one topic to keep it simple. How about Columbus? No, you didn't lie, but saying, though they had a keen interest in the peoples of the Caribbean, Columbus and his crews were never able to live peacefully among them, makes it seem as if Columbus did no wrong. The reason for not being able to live peacefully is that he and crew took slaves and killed thousands of Indians for not bringing enough gold. Another student wrote, "It seemed to me as if the publishers had just printed up some glory story that was supposed to make us feel more patriotic about our country. They want us to look at our country as great and powerful and forever right." A student named Rebecca wrote, "Of course, the writers of the books probably think it's harmless enough. What does it matter who discovered America, really? But the thought that I have been lied to all my life about this, and who knows what else, really makes me angry." A group was formed on the West Coast called Italian Americans Against Christopher Columbus, saying, "When Italian Americans identify with native people, we are bringing ourselves, each of us, closer to possible change in the world." In Los Angeles, a high school student named Blake Lindsay went before the city council to argue against celebrating the quincentennial. She spoke to the council about the genocide of the Arawaks, but she got no official response. However, when she told her story on a talk show, a woman phoned in who said she was from Haiti. "The girl is right. We have no Indians left. At our last uprising in Haiti, people destroyed the statue of Columbus. Let's have statues for the Aborigines." There were counter-Columbus activities all over the country, unmentioned in the press or on television. In Minnesota alone, a listing of such activities from 1992 reported dozens of workshops, meetings, films, art shows. At Lincoln Center in New York City on October 12th, there was a performance of Leonard Lehrman's New World, an opera about what Columbus did to the Indians. In Baltimore, there was a multimedia show about Columbus. In Boston, and then in a national tour, the Underground Railway Theater performed The Christopher Columbus Follies to packed audiences. The protests, the dozens of new books that were appearing about Indian history, the discussions taking place all over the country, were bringing about an extraordinary transformation in the educational world. For generations, exactly the same story had been told to all American school children about Columbus, a romantic, admiring story. Now, thousands of teachers around the country were beginning to tell that story differently. This aroused anger among defenders of the old history, who derided what they called a movement for political correctness and multiculturalism. They resented the critical treatment of Western expansion and imperialism, which they considered an attack on Western civilization. Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Education, William Bennett, had called Western civilization our common culture, its highest ideas and aspirations. A much-publicized book by a philosopher named Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, expressed horror at what the social movements of the 60s had done to change the educational atmosphere of American universities. To him, Western civilization was the high point of human progress, and the United States its best representative. America tells one story, the unbroken, ineluctable progress of freedom and equality. From its first settlers and its political foundings on, there has been no dispute that freedom and equality are the essence of justice for us. In the civil rights movement, black people disputed that claim of America's standing for freedom and equality. The women's movement had disputed that claim too. And now, in 1992, Native Americans were pointing to the crimes of Western civilization against their ancestors. They were recalling the communitarian spirit of the Indians Columbus met and conquered, trying to tell the history of those millions of people who were here before Columbus, giving the lie to what a Harvard historian, Perry Miller, had called the movement of European culture into the vacant wilderness of America. As the United States entered the 90s, the political system, whether Democrats or Republicans were in power, remained in the control of those who had great wealth. The main instruments of information were also dominated by corporate wealth. The country was divided, though no mainstream political leader would speak of it, into classes of extreme wealth and extreme poverty, separated by an insecure and jeopardized middle class. Yet there was, unquestionably, though largely unreported, what a worried mainstream journalist had called a permanent adversarial culture, which refused to surrender the possibility of a more equal, more humane society. If there was hope for the future of America, it lay in the promise of that refusal. President Bill Clinton was re-elected in 1996 with a distinct lack of voter enthusiasm, as was true in 1992 when 19% of the voters showed their distaste for both parties by voting for a third-party candidate, Ross Perot. The electorate was clearly not happy about its choices. Half of the eligible voters stayed away from the polls, and of those who did vote, only 49% chose Clinton over his lackluster opponent, Robert Dole. One bumper sticker read, "If God had intended us to vote, he would have given us candidates." At his second inauguration ceremony, Clinton spoke of the nation at the edge of a new century in a new millennium. He said, "We need a new government for a new century." But it was apparent from his weak support at the polls that Americans had seen nothing in Clinton's first 4 years to justify the claim that there would be a new government. It happened that the inauguration coincided with the nationwide celebration of the birthday of Martin Luther King, Jr., and Clinton invoked King's name several times in his address. The two men, however, represented very different social philosophies. By the time King was assassinated in 1968, he had come to believe that our economic system was fundamentally unjust and needed radical transformation. He spoke of the evils of capitalism and asked for a radical redistribution of economic and political power. On the other hand, as major corporations gave money to the Democratic Party on an unprecedented scale, Clinton demonstrated clearly in the 4 years of his first term in office his total confidence in the market system and private enterprise. During the 1992 campaign, the chief executive officer of Martin Marietta Corporation noted, "I think the Democrats are moving more toward business, and business is moving more toward the Democrats." Martin Luther King's reaction to the buildup of military power had been the same as his reaction to the Vietnam War. This madness must cease. And the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. Clinton was willing to recall King's dream of racial equality, but not his dream of a society rejecting violence. Even though the Soviet Union was no longer a military threat, he insisted that the United States must keep its armed forces dispersed around the globe, prepare for two regional wars, and continue the military budget at Cold War levels. Clinton had become the Democratic Party candidate in 1992 with a formula not for social change, but for electoral victory: move the party closer to the center. This meant doing just enough for blacks, women, and working people to keep their support, while trying to win over white conservative voters with a program of toughness on crime and a strong military. Once in office, Clinton appointed more people of color to government posts than his Republican predecessors. But if any prospective or actual appointees became too bold, Clinton abandoned them quickly. His Secretary of Commerce, Ronald Brown, who was killed in a plane crash, was black and a corporate lawyer, and Clinton was clearly pleased with him. On the other hand, Laney Guanyer, a black legal scholar who was up for a job with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, was abandoned when conservatives objected to her strong ideas on matters of racial equality and voter representation. And when Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, a black, made the controversial suggestion that masturbation was a proper subject in sex education, Clinton asked her to resign. He showed the same timidity in the two appointments he made to the Supreme Court, making sure that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer would be moderate enough to be acceptable to Republicans as well as to Democrats. He was not willing to fight for a strong liberal to follow in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall or William Brennan, who had recently left the court. Breyer and Ginsburg both defended the constitutionality of capital punishment and upheld drastic restrictions on the use of habeas corpus. Both voted with the most conservative judges on the court to uphold the constitutional right of Boston St. Patrick's Day parade organizers to exclude gay marchers. In choosing judges for the lower federal courts, Clinton showed himself no more likely to appoint liberals than the Republican Gerald Ford had in the 70s. According to a 3-year study published in the Fordham Law Review in early 1996, Clinton's appointments made liberal decisions in less than half their cases. The New York Times noted that while Reagan and Bush had been willing to fight for judges who would reflect their philosophies, Mr. Clinton, in contrast, has been quick to drop judicial candidates if there is even a hint of controversy. Clinton was eager to show he was tough on matters of law and order. Running for president in 1992, while still governor of Arkansas, he flew back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of a mentally retarded man on death row. And early in his administration, he and Attorney General Janet Reno approved an FBI attack on a group of religious zealots who were armed and ensconced in a building complex in Waco, Texas. The attack resulted in a fire that swept through the compound, killing at least 86 men, women, and children. Early in his first term, Clinton signed legislation cutting funds for state resource centers that supplied lawyers to indigent prisoners. The result, according to Bob Herbert, writing in the New York Times, was that a man facing the death penalty in Georgia had to appear at a habeas corpus proceeding without a lawyer. In 1996, the president signed legislation that made it more difficult for judges to put prison systems under special masters to ensure the improvement of terrible prison conditions. He also approved a new statute withholding federal funds for legal services where lawyers used those funds to handle class action suits. Such suits were important for challenging assaults on civil liberties. The Crime Bill of 1996, which both Republicans and Democrats in Congress voted for overwhelmingly, and which Clinton endorsed with enthusiasm, dealt with the problem of crime by emphasizing punishment, not prevention. It extended the death penalty to a whole range of criminal offenses and provided $8 billion for the building of new prisons. All this was to persuade voters that politicians were tough on crime. But as criminologist Todd Clear wrote in the New York Times, "Tougher is Dumber," about the new crime bill, harsher sentencing since 1973 had added 1 million people to the prison population, giving the United States the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and yet violent crime continued to increase. Why, Clear asked, do harsh penalties seem to have so little to do with crime? A crucial reason is that police and prisons have virtually no effect on the sources of criminal behavior. He pointed to those sources. About 70% of prisoners in New York State come from 8 neighborhoods in New York City. These neighborhoods suffer profound poverty, exclusion, marginalization, and despair. All these things nourish crime. Those holding political power, whether Clinton or his Republican predecessors, had something in common. They sought to keep their power by diverting the anger of citizens to groups without the resources to defend themselves. As H.L. Mencken, the acerbic social critic of the 1920s, put it, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary." Criminals were among these hobgoblins, also immigrants, people on welfare, and certain governments, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba. By turning attention to them, by inventing or exaggerating their dangers, the failures of the American system could be concealed. Immigrants were a convenient object of attack, because as non-voters, their interests could be safely ignored. It was easy for politicians to play upon the xenophobia that has erupted from time to time in American history, the anti-Irish prejudices of the mid-19th century, the continual violence against Chinese who had been brought in to work on the railroads, the hostility toward immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe that led to the restrictive immigration laws of the 1920s. The reform spirit of the 60s had led to an easing of restrictions on immigration, but in the 90s, Democrats and Republicans alike played on the economic fears of working Americans. Jobs were being lost because corporations were firing employees to save money, downsizing, or moving plants out of the country to more profitable situations. Immigrants, especially the large numbers coming over the southern border from Mexico, were blamed for taking jobs from citizens of the United States, for receiving government benefits, for causing higher taxes on American citizens. Both major political parties joined to pass legislation, which Clinton then signed, to remove welfare benefits, food stamps, payments to elderly and disabled people, from not only illegal, but legal immigrants. By early 1997, letters were going out to close to 1 million legal immigrants who were poor, old, or disabled, warning them that their food stamps and cash payments would be cut off in a few months unless they became citizens. For perhaps 500,000 legal immigrants, passing the tests required for becoming a citizen was quite impossible. They could not read English, were sick or disabled, or just too old to learn. An immigrant from Portugal living in Massachusetts told a reporter through an interpreter, Every day we are afraid the letter will come. What will we do if we lose our checks? We will starve. Oh my God, it will not be worth living. Illegal immigrants, fleeing poverty in Mexico, began to face harsher treatment in the early 90s. Thousands of border guards were added. A Reuters dispatch from Mexico City, April 3, 1997, said about the tougher policy, "Any crackdown against illegal immigration automatically angers Mexicans, millions of whom migrate legally and illegally across the 2,000-mile border to the United States in search of jobs each year."